Our next guest is Dr. Wendy Suzuki. She has written a new book called Good Anxiety, Harnessing the Power of the Most Misunderstood Emotion. Now, there are about 40 million people, or 18% of the population, suffering from clinical anxiety disorders today. Suzuki unpacks the cutting-edge science that will help readers channel their anxiety for positive outcomes. She believes this shift from bad to good anxiety accelerates focus and productivity. It can boost performance and create compassion and foster more creativity. Dr. Wendy Suzuki, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Well, it's nice to have you back on the show. And yes. I wanted to ask you, I mean, to me, as someone who I think I've never really suffered from anxiety, I look at this and I say, this is great. Turn your bad emotion into good. But I wonder if those who really deal with anxiety on an everyday basis,
KPCW,
if they feel like they
Park
could
City,
ever turn it into something
cool
good,
radio.
Even a superpower.
Science and technology that's
yes.
accessible
so that's
and
a good
entertaining.
Question. Really,
if
really
we can understand it, you can
book.
Understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells.
For people with clinical levels of anxiety, that is a different situation. You need medical professional help for that. This book is really written for the lower ends of the spectrum of anxiety, which I call everyday anxiety. And it's not about getting rid of the bad, uncomfortable feelings of anxiety. In fact, I argue that those uncomfortable feelings are essential. They are protective. It's about harnessing the energy that comes with those feelings and channeling it. I'm not going to get away where nobody's going to kind of remove these negative feelings, but it is a mindset shift about what these uncomfortable feelings can teach you about yourself and how you can help channel those the activation that comes with anxiety for more positive purposes instead of just letting it kind of fester into just more anxiety.
This is a very interesting distinction you make. And I want to just say that even those with clinical anxiety, I have a young woman that I'm very close to who has mm-hmm. had anxiety her entire life. But what I see with her is this thing that's really positive. She has to do things so far in advance. She has to be so organized with her life. She has to have yes. her life planned out well in advance. And I have seen it, at least from my perspective, be very, very positive. Like, she's got her act together so much more than I did when I was her age, because I usually kind of wait to the last minute to do things, maybe because I just don't worry. And I have wanted her to look at that as a positive thing. How could, what do you say to that person to help her, you know, get over that and actually be able to look at even clinical anxiety as something positive?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's great. And all of those virtues that you see from the adaptations that your friend has made can be good. These are all the same kind of adaptations that I'm talking to. That I'm speaking to people that have everyday anxiety. I want to be really clear. I am not a clinician. This book is not meant to treat somebody with clinical levels of anxiety. That's not meant to say that people with clinical anxiety can't read the book and use some of these mindset shifts that I'm talking about. You know, this book was not written that is the only treatment that they have, but it could be useful. And similarly, the beneficial effects or the benefits that come from their addressing anxiety that somebody with clinical anxiety might have could also be good. And so it's, again, at its core, anxiety, the emotion of anxiety is protective. And what I say in Good Anxiety for the non-clinically anxious people, the first thing we need is to turn down the volume of our anxiety, because part of the reason why it's lost its protective element is that we all have higher levels of anxiety than was, you know, evolved, that we were evolved to have. And so we first want to turn down that anxiety. And I'll say, you know, one of the things I realized when I was writing this book is that I realized I was an anxiety denier, and that I like to just mask my own anxiety as, oh, I'm just fine. I'm fine. I don't have anxiety. For me personally, I realized how much anxiety was in my everyday life in writing this book. And so gave me all these opportunities to employ all of these approaches that I talked about. We researched, we talked to lots of people, and that's what we came up with in this book, Good Anxiety, all of these approaches.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Dr. Wendy Suzuki, who has written Good Anxiety, Harnessing the Power of the Most Misunderstood Emotion. Wendy, I wanted to ask you, you know, my grandmother used to tell me, my mother used to tell me, take a deep breath, just relax. And the truth is, if you take a deep breath, or you take a whole bunch of them, you really do relax. What is going on medically when we take deep breaths, long deep breaths through our nose?
Yeah, well, your grandmother and your mother were right, because by taking deep breaths, you are literally activating your stress reduction part of your nervous system. I think people don't realize that we have a part of our nervous system that is explicitly designed to help decrease our stress. It's called the parasympathetic nervous system. And when it gets activated, it decreases our heart rate, decreases our respiration rate, and pushes blood into our digestive and reproductive systems. And so the best way to activate that consciously is to take a deep breath. I recommend box breathing, which is a 4-count on an inhale, hold at the top for 4 counts, a deep exhale for 4 counts, and hold it at the bottom. So from the neuroscience perspective, you are activating your parasympathetic stress reduction nervous system with those deep breaths, and it's not surprising that breath work is one of the oldest forms of meditation that exists as well.
Yeah, sure is. And I was curious enough to, you know, go online and try to learn a little bit more about it, and I found this thing called coherent breathing. And it's when you take between 4 and 6 breaths per minute. And these are deep breaths through your nose, and you engage your diaphragm. And they were talking about increased blood flow. Muscles that were tense are now relaxed or could be relaxed. Mm-hmm. If you had discomfort in your body, you could now have comfort. Your body wouldn't hurt. Your mind, if you had an anxious feeling, hey, you know, I'm late for a meeting, someone just cut me off in traffic, something like that. You're at ease. And then the last two are in learning. You could have some challenges versus be more of a natural learner, be more relaxed. And the thing that I got the most out of this was sleeping. And that's why I'm going to be trying this, is because if you are a troubled sleeper, you can have more restful sleep. Well, is that what you're talking about, coherent breathing?
You know, the thing that helps most people is not necessarily that specific kind of breathing. It's simpler than that. Just take deep, long breaths. That is the most direct way to activate this kind of stress reduction part of your nervous system. And what I like to say is that everybody has their own kind of way that they like to breathe deeply most. And so you found this one that was fascinating to you. I invite everybody, go on YouTube. There are literally hundreds of different YouTube videos about short kinds of breathing exercises. They're there for free. Try them out. Which one resonates with you? Which one feels good for you? Some of them have you hold your breath for a really long time. I don't like those. That's why I recommend this box breathing. It's easy to remember, four steps. And that simple act of breathing deeply in and out is what's going to activate this anxiety-reducing response in your nervous system.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Dr. Wendy Suzuki. She's written a new book called Good Anxiety, Harnessing the Power of the most misunderstood emotion. And Wendy, I wanted to ask you a little bit about this distinction between clinical and non-clinical anxiety. I have a friend who's a school counselor, and she was telling me that in schools, there is maybe an overdiagnosis or pathologizing other emotions, labeling them as anxiety, and wondering about how this whole diagnosis is evolving, you know, calling sometimes stress, nervousness, and ADHD anxiety. How does it interfere with the actual diagnosis of clinical anxiety? And do you just treat those as two separate things?
Two separate things, clinical anxiety versus what's the other thing?
Non-clinical anxiety, the one that you're talking more about in your book.
Yes. Well, I do treat them as very different things for the simple reason that clinical anxiety is anxiety that is truly debilitating. This is not something it's like a broken leg. You need to go to a medical professional to address. And again, I am not a clinician, which is why I focused on the everyday anxiety, the lower end of that spectrum. And what I would say is, if you're wondering where you fall on that spectrum, are you able to function at all? Or if you're an adult, you know, are you unable to work? Is it affecting your social links and social connections? That is, if it is debilitating in that way, that suggests that you do have clinical anxiety, you should go seek medical help. I wanted to focus on on everyday anxiety, because the vast majority of the population feels this. How do I know this? Well, even before the pandemic, 90% of Americans raised their hands and said, I have feelings of anxiety. And that 90% has gone up even more since the pandemic. So these are approaches, neuroscience-based approaches, that help that larger population kind of deal with the higher levels of anxiety that we have right now, and provide a new way to think about anxiety, and lots of tools to enact those steps that I talk about in the book.
You have this great questionnaire or sort of a distinction in the beginning of your book about everyday anxiety versus anxiety disorder, clinical anxiety. And the example is everyday anxiety, and I think many of us can say we feel this, a case of nerves or sweating before a big test, a business presentation, stage performance, or other significant event, while the anxiety disorder would be a seemingly out of the blue panic attack, the preoccupation with the fear of having another one. And it's interesting, we have talked to Dan Harris, who kind of became infamous for that panic attack he had as an ABC, you know, national news correspondent, and out of that has come his, you know, whole forum of 10% happier.
Yes, journey.
And I said to him, you know, I viewed your panic attack that was on national TV, and I couldn't really tell that anything was wrong with you. You took a deep breath once, but that was all I saw. And he said, that's because you've never had a panic attack before. And I think that's, you know, it's good. It really gives you empathy for someone who is going through all of this sort of thing. So, and I would say, I think we all have felt, some amount of anxiety during the pandemic. Usually we can say, I feel kind of panicky right now. I'm going to go jump on my bike for an hour, and when I get back, I know I'll feel better. Those are tools that we can use, and these are the kind of tools that you talk about in your book. What are some other tools?
Yes. So I always start with deep breathing, because that is the easiest, fastest way. It could help in the middle of an anxiety-provoking conversation. People really can't tell that you're, you know, deeply breathing in and out. You bring up my number two on my list, which is physical activity. So get outside, which stimulates the release of neurotransmitters like dopamine and serotonin, that has a a clear and immediate decreasing of feelings of anxiety, depression that I've studied in my lab at New York University. But what I offer is a whole wide range of additional tools that act not just immediately like movement and deep breathing, but have a medium or a long time frame that include things like changing your mindset. I give you lots of activities that you can do to try and emotionally regulate. If you know there's an anxious, anxiety-provoking situation coming your way, what can you do before that situation to prepare? Kind of like what you're saying, I'm sure your friend with clinical anxiety has preparation rituals. Well, the rest of us that know that there's going to be some anxiety there can do some of those same things, kind of plan for that, make sure that the venue is beneficial for that. You'll have your immediate effects to calm you if you start to get anxious during the event itself. Again, we've talked about breathing, and that is probably the best way to do that. And then there are approaches that you can take, kind of emotional regulation strategies they can use after the meeting. What was that moment that was the most anxious? Were there other things that you maybe didn't do but you could do next time? It is a kind of cognitive reappraisal and staying creative and activist about how you are approaching these anxiety situations. You may not ever remove these feelings of anxiety because they're telling you this is an important or difficult kind of situation. It is a warning. If you didn't have any warning, you would be walking into all sorts of danger with no warning at all. But there are lots of things that we can do to help decrease those feelings, to help make us feel better about going into even the most anxiety-provoking situations that we face in our lives.
It's also good to have some repetitive things so that you can, over time, get used to things. You know, live radio is an adventure. And when Lynn and I started Cool Science Radio, it was about 10 years ago, every once in a while, it doesn't happen that often, but every once in a while, a guest won't show up or they'll cancel at the very last minute. And, you know, we used to, be a little freaked out about the whole thing. But then we would, Lynn's looking at me now, we're both laughing. But now, we have a couple of taped interviews if we have an emergency, or we can, we talk a little bit. We always have cool stories to talk about on the science, from the science community, and until we get the guest on air. But I think with time, we've been able to adopt better. Lynn, what do you think about that?
Yeah, well, it's just going back to what Wendy says, is you identify your triggers. Your trigger is your guest not showing up. You have dead air on live radio. And then you identify how to, how to adapt.
Yeah. You know what I'm curious about is the thing you talked about earlier, anxiety as a protective mechanism. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Was this back in the Serengeti? Is this back thousands and thousands of years ago that all this happened?
Yeah. So, in fact, we can go back millions of years, 2.5 million years ago. Imagine you're a woman 2.5 million years ago with a newborn baby kind of collecting food, and what you hear, the crack of a twig. That could indicate danger. It could indicate a predator nearby. And that immediately initiates this feeling of anxiety, that fear or worry that comes up in uncertain situations. Is it a lion or is it a raccoon? And so that also immediately stimulates the underlying physiological response that comes with anxiety, that increase in heart rate, that increase in respiration, and the shunting of blood from your digestive and reproductive systems to your muscles. What is the physiology? What is your body preparing you to do? Preparing that woman's body to either run away really fast from the predator or fight the predator. This is the classic fight or flight response that every single one of us today still has. And the difficult thing is that it doesn't just get generated when there is a lion right about to attack you, but if there's a possibility of danger coming up, danger from everything from a, well, here in New York City, a rat coming at me, or from things like global warming, or, of course, the coronavirus pandemic. We are being, our anxiety response and that stress response that comes with it are being activated so much more in our modern lifestyles. That is why our anxiety response is, the volume is turned way up. And so that's why I give so many tools in the book to help all of us turn that volume down so we can benefit from that more protective element of those feelings. And what is that protective element? Well, can you turn in and ask, why am I afraid of this conversation? I'm sure you've already turned in, to go back to your example, you've turned in to ask, why am I afraid of dead air on live radio? Well, it doesn't sound good. It makes you sound unprepared. And this is not a good thing for your career. So you have clearly adapted lots of different approaches to mitigate this anxiety-provoking situation. But I will offer another thing. I bet you that this is also a situation that comes from a big anxiety of doing live radio that might have made you a little bit more empathetic for people that, oh my God, you know, my kid broke his leg, and that's why I couldn't get on your show. I'm sure you've heard all excuses, truthful and not so truthful, about that. But the truth is that it happens in the best situations. I found that myself, students, you know, making appointments with me, and, you know, where were you? I was sitting there waiting on the Zoom meeting. That is one of the superpowers that can come from your deepest anxieties. That is empathy for yourself. Like, it's okay to feel that, but also empathy for the other side, that things do happen. And I think that's one of the most powerful gifts or superpowers that can come from your own anxiety that I talk about in this book. Why? Because I can't think of anything that the world needs right now than more empathy.
Oh, yeah, absolutely right. We're speaking with Dr. Wendy Suzuki. Her book is Good Anxiety. She's a professor of neuroscience and psychology in the Center for Neuroscience at New York University. She's also a celebrated international authority on neuroplasticity. And I wanted to ask you about neuroplasticity and anxiety. I mean, 10 years ago, it seems like 10, 15 years ago, we had never heard that term, neuroplasticity, and how malleable the brain is, how we can really fundamentally change who we are. Because I think that when we are diagnosed with, say, anxiety at an early age, we think, yeah, it's going to be that way the rest of my life. I'm just going to have to deal with it. But with the brain so plastic, I mean, what would you say even about clinical anxiety? Is there a way to retrain your brain away from it?
Well, yes, in fact, and that is a lot of the therapy that people have developed and people are doing, including the pharmacological therapy, is designed to change the brain so there isn't this going back to the same habits and going back to the same feelings of anxiety. So it's important to realize that those events, perhaps in your childhood, difficult events or difficult situations that you experience that caused anxiety or PTSD or many other kind of emotional problems, that's also an example of brain plasticity. Your brain changed in response to very difficult situations. But because I've studied brain plasticity for my entire career, it makes me very, very optimistic that people, and again, I'm talking about people with everyday anxiety, that the focus of this book, can use these tools to retrain their brain and learn to help decrease those levels of anxiety and kind of learn to channel their anxieties into the gifts that I talk about, into that protection that it was designed to be. I'm really, really optimistic. And for clinical anxiety, again, I'm not a clinician. That is what all of these treatments are designed to do, to shift that brain, to shift the learning. It's more difficult in those clinical levels of anxiety, but we are using our understanding of brain plasticity to help make that happen.
Our guest is Dr. Wendy Suzuki, introducing some hope and empathy into this either diagnosis or non-diagnosis, self-diagnosis, I guess I could say, about anxiety. Yeah. The book is Good Anxiety, Harnessing the Power of the Most Misunderstood Emotion. Wendy, thank you so much for joining us today on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. A pleasure to be here on Cool Science.
Take care. Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening, and hey, tune in next week.